A disproportionate fuss has been made over the detailed atrocities in Belgium, disproportionate, that is, in relation to the fundamental atrocity of August 1914, which was the invasion of Belgium. Given that, the casual shootings and lootings, the wanton destruction of property, the plundering of inns, and of food and drink shops by hungry and weary men, and the consequent rapes and incendiarism follow naturally enough. Only very simple people believe that an army in the field can maintain as high a level of honesty, decency, and justice as a settled community at home, and the tradition of the 30 Years' War still influenced the Prussian army. It's been customary in the countries allied against Germany to treat all this vileness and bloodshed of the Belgian months as though nothing of the sort had ever happened before, and as if it were due to some distinctively evil strain in the German character. They were nicknamed Huns. But nothing could be less like the systematic destruction of these nomads, who once proposed to exterminate the entire Chinese population in order to restore China to pasture, than the German crimes in Belgium. Much of that crime was the drunken brutality of men who, for the first time in their lives, were free to use lethal weapons. Much of it was the hysterical violence of men shocked at their own proceedings and in deadly fear of the revenge of the people whose country they had outraged. And much of it was done under duress, because of the theory that men should be terrible in warfare and that populations are best subdued by fear. The German common people were bundled from an orderly obedience into this war in such a manner that atrocities were bound to ensue. They certainly did horrible and disgusting things, but any people who had been worked up for war and led into war as the Germans were would have behaved in a similar manner. On the night of August 2nd, while most of Europe, still under the tranquil inertias of half a century of peace, still in the habitual enjoyment of such a widely diffused plenty and cheapness and freedom as no man living will ever see again, was thinking about its summer holidays, the little Belgian village of Vizay was ablaze, and stupefied rustics were being led out and shot because it was alleged someone had fired on the invaders. The officers who ordered these acts, the men who obeyed, must surely have felt scared at the strangeness of the things they did. Most of them had never yet seen a violent death, and they had set light not to a village, but a world. It was the beginning of the end of an age of comfort, confidence, and gentle and seemly behavior in Europe. So soon as it was clear that Belgium was to be invaded, Great Britain ceased to hesitate, and at 11 at night on August 4th, declared war upon Germany. The following day, a German mine-laying vessel was caught off the Thames mouth by the cruiser Amphion and sunk, the first time that the British and Germans had ever met in conflict under their own national flags, upon land or water. All Europe still remembers the strange atmosphere of those eventful sunny August days, the end of the armed peace. For nearly half a century, the Western world had been tranquil and had seemed safe. Only a few middle-aged and aging people in France had had any practical experience of warfare. The newspapers spoke of a world catastrophe, and that conveyed very little meaning to those for whom the world had always seemed secure and were indeed almost incapable of thinking of it as otherwise than secure. In Britain, particularly, for some weeks, the peacetime routine continued in a slightly dazed fashion. It was like a man still walking about the world unaware that he has contracted a fatal disease which will alter every routine and habit in his life. People went on with their summer holidays. Shops reassured their customers with the announcement, "Business as usual." There was much talk and excitement when the newspapers came, but it was the talk and excitement of spectators, who have no vivid sense of participation in the catastrophe that was presently to involve them all. 8th. We'll now review very briefly the main phases of the world struggle which had thus commenced. Planned by Germany, it began with a swift attack designed to knock out France while Russia was still getting her forces together in the east. For a time, all went well. Military science is never up to date under modern conditions because military men are, as a class, unimaginative. There are always, at any date, undeveloped inventions capable of disturbing current tactical and strategic practice which the military intelligence has declined. The German plan had been made for some years. It was a stale plan. It could probably have been foiled at the outset by a proper use of entrenchments and barbed wire and machine guns, but the French were by no means as advanced in their military science as the Germans, and they trusted to methods of open warfare that were at least 14 years behind the times. They had a proper equipment, neither of barbed wire nor machine guns, and there was a ridiculous tradition that the Frenchmen didn't fight well behind earthworks. The Belgian frontier was defended by the fortress of Liège, 10 or 12 years out of date, with forts whose armament had been furnished and fitted in many cases by German contractors, and the French northeastern frontier was very badly equipped. Naturally, the German armament firm of Krupp had provided nutcrackers for these nuts in the form of exceptionally heavy guns firing high-explosive shell. These defences proved, therefore, to be mere traps for their garrisons. The French attacked and failed in the southern Ardennes. The German hosts swung round the French left with an effect of being irresistible. Liège fell on August the 9th. Brussels was reached on August the 20th, and the small British army of about 70,000 which had arrived in Belgium was struck at Mons on August the 22nd in overwhelming force and driven backward in spite of the very deadly rifle tactics it had learned during the South African War. The little British force was pushed aside westward, and the German right swept down so as to leave Paris to the west and crumple the entire French army back upon itself. So confident was the German higher command at this stage of having won the war that by the end of August German troops were already being withdrawn for the Eastern Front, where the Russians were playing havoc in East and West Prussia. And then came the French counterattack, strategically a very swift and brilliant counterattack. The French struck back on their centre. They produced an unexpected army on their left, and the small British army, shaken but reinforced, was still fit to play a worthy part in the counterstroke. The German right overran itself, lost its cohesion, and was driven back from the Marne to the Aisne. The Battle of the Marne, September the 6th to the 10th. It would have been driven back farther had it not had the art of entrenchment in reserve. Upon the Aisne it stood and dug itself in. The heavy guns, the high explosive shell, the tanks needed by the Allies to smash up these entrenchments didn't yet exist. The Battle of the Marne shattered the original German plan. For a time, France was saved, but the German wasn't defeated. He had still a great offensive superiority in men and equipment. His fear of the Russian in the east had been relieved by a tremendous victory at Tannenberg. His next phase was a headlong, less elaborately planned campaign to outflank the left of the Allied armies and to seize the Channel ports and cut off supplies coming from Britain to France. Both armies extended to the west in a sort of race to the coast. Then the Germans, with a great superiority of guns and equipment, struck at the British round and about Ypres. They came very near to a breakthrough, but the British held them.